From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Jazz music, its history and contemporary directions. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are the Mitchell Ruff Duo, Willie Ruff and Dwight Mitchell. The Mitchell Ruff Duo is the oldest continuous group in jazz, formed in 1955, when pianist Dwight Mitchell and bassist and French horn player Willie Ruff left the Lionel Hampton Band to strike out on their own. In 1959, the Mitchell Ruff Duo introduced Soviet audiences to American jazz. Since then, the duo has performed worldwide. Joining in the conversation with the Mitchell Ruff Duo is Gary Shivers of WUNC Radio in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Mitchell and Ruff, you guys are ambassadors of jazz. Are you comfortable with that title? Dwight, let me start with you. Do you feel some sort of special responsibility as a musician doing jazz and taking it all over the world?
Yes, I think it's important. It's important to me and Ruff to do what we can to sort of educate or not educate particularly, but to bring our music to as many people as possible, mm-hmm. and explain where our music came from and how it works and that sort of thing.
How about you, Willie? Do you feel, are you a musician or are you a diplomat? What's the mixture?
I'm a musician.
Uh-huh.
I'm not very diplomatic.
Tell me about some of the experiences that you've had. You've been in Russia, you've been in China, you've taken your music all over the world. Willie?
Russia is a fertile ground for all things Western, simply because it's been denied for so long, and anything that's been denied for a long time finds fertile ground. America is a place in which jazz was denied wide exposure for so long, and I think that also accounts for some of the reasons it's so much in demand in the corners that it is in demand now. For instance, when we all were students and trying to play jazz in plastic in practice rooms on campuses, we were not encouraged. As a matter of fact, often punished. And we see a new day now when presidents of colleges and deans of schools of music and conservatories are not just jazz listeners and appreciators, but in many cases, jazz players. Mitchell and I first started touring colleges, black colleges, among other colleges in the United States in the mid-50s, 55, 56, and on one campus in Alabama. The president of the college refused to let us play on the good piano. Now,
let me ask you a blunt question. Was that because you were black, or is that because of the kind of music that you were doing?
Because of the kind of music.
It was because of the kind of music.
All right.
Yeah. No, it didn't have anything to do with color. This man was the same color as we were. It had to do simply with the low place of jazz music. Jazz music, I could give you some examples of that. We hear a lot about music being a universal language. There are large parts of the world in which people's entire melodic experience is made up of five notes. Rhythm, humans react to rhythm in interesting physiological ways. And few people have taken the time to relate that to the way humans exist and make their transactions in a field of gravity. That's at the core of a human's association and transaction of rhythm. Some cultures are phenomenally advanced in their rhythmic. I mean, we couldn't start, even with the musical experience that Mitchell and I have, now we couldn't start to understand a group of Indian musicians from Bombay or Calcutta, simply because they have developed sophistication in rhythmic transactions that are just so complex, where ours has been developed along other lines, along the lines of harmony, along the lines of a transaction with the Overtone series that we find as a natural order and as a natural phenomenon. Well, time is a medium in which meter then takes place, and then meter is the frame for rhythm. And often the two or the three are mixed up.
The problem is, it seems to me, is in trying to identify a time or a rhythm that is universally understood.
Well, there are natural events in humans that are timed and pretty universal, like heartbeats. If you measure the heartbeat of a pygmy, it's pretty much the same as yours and mine, as our temperatures that way. So that to the extent that natural order or natural design makes humans' hearts beat or their respiration measured to a certain rate, then these transactions can be thought to be universal. But beyond that, it's a matter of very much of a large matter of conditioning and also social influence. For instance, Mitchell and I, in all of our explications of jazz and its background for new audiences, whether they are American children or Chinese teenagers, always point to one thing, which I will demonstrate for your microphone. That is, nobody else in the world does this. It comes from right here in this part of the world, and it happened here because there was a larger social story here.
Now wait a minute, Will. You're talking about the South. When you say here, what
yes,
do you mean?
I mean the South is right. Okay. We are in North Carolina, last time I heard. And this story has to do with drumming. And we always tell our new audiences that the drum has no rival as the instrument of importance in say, West African culture. And that when West Africans were brought to America as slaves, one of the first laws governing their behavior was the law of speech and drumming. And these two were so closely related that a drummer in West African society could recite tribal history, recite proverbs, without recourse to speech. Imagine, if you will, the ability to recite the Gettysburg Address without words, but by having it played on the drum. In American slave society, that gift or that skill was considered to be dangerous. It could possibly be used for insurrection, for organizing revolts, and it had to be outlawed. This single law brought about tremendous cultural consequences, both good and both bad. Some of the good ones were the fact that we then had a culture in America that was forced to invent some drum substitutes, some that never existed anywhere in the world before. As a result, nobody else invented tap dancing. Nobody else invented the blues. Nobody else invented boogie-woogie. Nobody else invented bebop. Nobody else invented the ham bone. Can I give you an example of what the ham bone is?
Fire away.
It's one of the important drum substitutes. It is done in the absence of the drum, and the people without the drum have no need to do the ham bone. They do all of that kind of thing with the drum. The human body then serves as the substitute for the drum. One needs only hands, thigh, chest, and whatever else you're good enough to put in. Let me demonstrate, okay? This is a ham bone. Now, I'm doing it with one hand now, but you should be able to hear it with the microphone if I double up. Now, nobody else in the world does this. We invented it, just like we invented jazz, the spirituals, and tap dancing. And you just don't have to be confined or restricted to the chest and the thighs. You can use your mouth sort of in a pucker. So that's the ham bone.
With a touch of the samba.
They come from the same places.
No, I don't do the ham bone.
Dwight, let me ask you to compliment some of the things that Willie Ruff has been saying and attempt to define maybe the impossible here. Tell me about the chemistry that exists between you two guys. Is that just something that happens that you can't really put into speech?
Tell me about that. I can try to talk about it a little bit, but it so happens that we've known each other since we were children, and we sort of grew up together. We met in the Air Forces as he was 14 years old. Ruff was 14 years old. And we both were very young. So I taught him to play the bass when we were in the Air Forces. And he then, we played a radio show together in Lockburn, Ohio.
Etta Wilson.
Doing this radio show, we got a lot of things together with just piano and bass. We had no drums even then. We just played piano and bass. And then we sort of, I was discharged. He was discharged. He went to Yale. I went to Philadelphia Musical Academy in Philadelphia. And as it happened that he saw me on the Ed Sullivan Show with Lionel Hampton, and we got back together again. As a matter of fact, he became a member of the Hamptons band after he saw me in the band, and we started rehearsing then for our duo while we were within the Hamptons band. And of course, it was being in the Hamptons band. Sometimes it's like it's like politics. I mean, everybody knows what everybody's doing, so they were told that we were rehearsing for a duo, and I think it led to firing him. And when he was fired, I left. And we've played together ever since.
Gary Shivers, how would you describe the chemistry between these two guys? You're interested in rhythm, and is there a language that they share that's private that the rest of us really don't participate in? Help me with that.
I think that's the language we've been trying to talk about throughout this half hour, trying to identify what it is that musicians share and try to share with audiences. The duo has been called in Jazz Times Magazine the baddest, swinginest piano-bass combination in jazz, and it has been for more than 30 years. You've described it as an irreducible minimum.
For a group, that's right. You can't get smaller than two and be a group.
You can have groups of one. Bill Evans piano solos.
Willie Ruff, tell us a little bit about what you've described jazz as. It's American, it's Afro-American. You talked about this course at Yale. Astronomers, philosophers, neurosurgeons. Talk in more less academic, more what popular terms. What are some of the forces that help to shape your music? Do you read the papers and see a story and think, well, here's something I want to write about that I want to express musically? How does that happen to you?
No, I never consciously try to express any ideas in music. I just
now wait. The music historians are going to run away. You're telling us that.
Well, music historians don't improvise either.
Okay,
they don't play jazz.
All right.
Another way of stating the question is: what is the subject of your improvisation?
There is no subject.
It's the music itself. It's the time.
Right. And we never know what it's going to be until it is music created at the point of performance. And to think about it in advance and say, I am going to go on the stage and express what I saw on my way over there. That's not our business.
How do you know it's any good?
Do you
judge yourselves? Do you just leave that to the critics? Dwight, help me with that one.
I tell you, when we play, usually we played so long, you know, it's over 30 years. And if you've improvised for 30 years, you can immediately, there are sometimes I miss, you know, but you can immediately tell when composition is happening. I mean, it starts from the beginning and it goes right through the end, and it's almost like as though it were planned. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be that, and you can feel it as it's going along. Yeah. You know what to play next, you know what to play
Time is one definition of jazz itself. Gunther Schuller has tried to describe it as forward propelling directionality. Martin Williams just drew the distinction in a recent article between fusion jazz, which to him seems to stand still, and the jazz we're talking about, which always seems to move forward. It's that movement in time that defines jazz in a way.
Willie Ruff?
I don't have anything to add or do it. Fine.
You'll buy that as a definition of jazz. I think it's
I don't buy it as a definition of jazz. I'll buy it as a statement by someone who has that to say, but it's not a definition of jazz.
To me, it's a description of what you do when you play.
But that's not a definition, though.
Is it your intent? Is that part of your intent?
Not really.
To create that sense of movement?
Well, movement is certainly a large part of the consideration, because it is a dynamic medium and it does have to move. To me, it's more instinctive is the time in which it moves. What is more difficult for me is where to move. And there are so many more considerations about that. I sort of put on automatic the rhythmic part. I'm more concerned with tonality. It's going to happen in a rhythmic frame. It has to express itself rhythmically, otherwise, I mean, it's no other way for it to happen, for it to find expression. But the harmony of it, there's so much to be thought of it from that standpoint. It's so much to be thought of from the standpoint of elegance of line. A line that makes sense. Time I would have to agree that it is as important as any other element there, but for me it is the most natural of the one. It's the one that I have to give least thought, is one to which I have to give least thought, because it's an elemental part of it there. It's more I don't think that much about the mechanics of playing the horn or the mechanics of playing the bass. I do think and have to think, because harmony this is the area of great development in Western music, and all Western music, and jazz is certainly, I mean, one of the things that's distinctive about jazz music is that faster than any other music from Western civilization, it has spanned a wider area of harmonic sophistication in fewer years than any other music. I mean, we go from the music of pre-Louis Armstrong, which was less than 75 years ago, less than 100 years ago. I mean, they start 1900, about the time they started to call jazz. And jazz music has developed from the very simplistic kinds of music that was almost hymn-like and spiritual music-like in its harmonic complexity, up to what you hear new jazz composers, Charlie Mingus and beyond. Which has the harmonic sophistication of Penderecki or Bartok or Stravinsky. And jazz has transcended all of that within a period of 75. Now, that's a lot to think about. That's one hell of a lot to think about. And the fact that we have had this kind of giant intellect at work in this medium, like Charlie Parker, and like John Coltrane, like Dizzy, and like Miles Davis, who would have more to say about harmonic construction and melodic construction than about rhythm. Rhythm is the one that's, and time is the one that's assumed more often than not. I've not heard of people making the great rhythmic leaps and leaps in transaction of time the way they have been made in Western music, and in particularly in our music, in the way of harmony, the negotiation of harmony, and that's a very complex subject.
Gary Shivers again.
Jazz didn't make those leaps in a vacuum. It made it in the context of world music.
That's right.
And those bop musicians in the 40s were studying Bartok and Stravinsky.
Right. Absolutely.
You studied with Hindemith.
Yes.
Are you saying that jazz is somehow a synthesis of all these musics and has advanced them all?
Yes, I would agree.
Yes. Yes, it is very much shaped by what has gone along. And you know the reason you'd like to hear the reason I went to Yale to study with Paul Hindemith? most phenomenal thing. I had taught myself to play the French horn in boiler rooms in the segregated army situation. And I had, as Mitchell said, I'd gone in the military, I'd run away from home in the ninth grade. And I got tutored by black officers and their wives, and I was ready to go to Yale when I was 17. But I didn't know that I wanted to go to Yale until I read a jazz magazine interview with Charlie Parker. Somebody said, "Charlie Parker, you are at the top of the heap of jazz performers and of the jazz thinkers of this time. If you could afford to take the next several years of your life and do with it what you wanted to do, what would you do?" And he says, "I've heard about a little German cat who is teaching composition in New Haven at a place called Yale, and I would go there and sit at his feet and learn me some music." Well, that settled it for what I should do with my life at that point and where I should do it. I went to New Haven, and they allowed me to come to school there on the GI Bill, and I sat at the feet of that little German cat whose name was Paul Hindemann. That was the reason.
Gary Shivers from WUNC.
It may be a myth about jazz among listeners, and maybe even some musicians, that because it's so spontaneous and improvisatory and intuitive, that it may also be unstudied and uninformed. Mm. That what you're saying is that Charlie Parker knew exactly what he was doing.
Yes. Well, there's one thing that's important to remember about America, and the coming of age of this music that we're talking about. When we listen to the players of Louis Armstrong's generation, we're listening to one pretty well homogenous group from the experience of their opportunity to be exposed to other things. Let's call it education. The truancy laws in America are very important and not properly credited. When Charlie Parker, Miles, Mitchell, and I came along and were starting to be trained, we had to go to school. The law says that we had to go to school. It didn't say that for Louis Armstrong. Truancy laws were not in effect back then. Not the in-lawing of education didn't say. It gave some conditions in parts of the country. It said that in some parts of the country it had to be separate and unequal, but it had to be one, and even at the lowest level like that. So that by the time the 1940s and the war years were coming along, we had a more sophisticated, a better educated populace. They demanded, needed, cried out for a more sophisticated music. And luckily, Charlie Parker was there, Thelonious Monk was there, Dizzy was there. These are giant intellects. I mean, people just, I have made a series of taped interviews. One that I'll never forget with Earl Hines. And I asked Earl Hines to several things. I have a lot of hours there with him. But and one, I asked him who was the most impressive musician he'd ever, who impressed him most in his experience. And I was surprised to hear him say Charlie Parker. And I said, "Well, why was that?" And he says, "Well," he says, "Dizzy was in my band, and it might have been somebody else. I'm not clear that it was Dizzy. Who, while they were somewhere in Chicago, Earl Hines is." Alto saxophone player, first alto player, got sick, and they got Charlie Parker from someplace. And they had a rehearsal in the afternoon and said, "Charlie Parker was told all the pieces, and he put them on the stand and read them through. And perfect, no, nothing, the band sounded better than it ever had before." And then said, "Okay, you guys have enough time off now. It's just a rehearsal to show him the ropes. And then we have 2 hours for dinner, and we come back and we play on the radio." And he said, everybody was ready to play, and he started to count off the time. Said, "Okay, one, two," and he looked and saw Charlie Parker didn't have the music out. And he went over and says, "Hey, man, I just told you to put the tune up there." And Charlie Parker says, "Go ahead and play it." And they played it, and he didn't have the music up there, and he absolute perfection from playing it one time in the afternoon. He had memorized everything he'd done that afternoon, played, and with no mistakes. Earl Hines said, from that time on, when it was time to pay him, I let somebody else do it. I didn't even go near him. So I've never seen a musical personality with that kind of intelligence and tenacity and will and gift. And he was phenomenal in a lot of it. Dizzy's a math genius. Now, you should see him in a classroom, in a blackboard, and chalk with a group of children with numbers. And you hear that in his playing. I mean, these social conditions brought on by such developments as truancy laws had their effect, and you see it in the music.
The Mitchell Ruff Duo, Gary Shivers from WUNC. Let's conclude our conversation. Do you guys think of yourselves as defenders of jazz? Do you think of yourselves that you're extending it? What would you tell people who are skeptical about it, who wonder about its legitimacy as an art form and its place in our culture? Dwight, does that sort of thing need defense?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't.
Why not?
I just think that the music speaks for itself.
Willie?
I think he's right. I agree with him. I have never seen in recent times a serious or responsible position against this music. It's stronger than any mind that I could think of that would have anything really negative to say about it. And it doesn't need us to defend it. It is, and it's beyond. It's certainly beyond that. It's stronger than that. Do you know anybody who can take a serious position against jazz music? Can't imagine such a thing.
Dwight Mitchell and Willie Ruff comprise the Mitchell Ruff Duo, the oldest continuous group in jazz. Joining in the conversation with the Mitchell Ruff Duo was Gary Shivers of WUNC Radio in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of the Mitchell Ruff Duo on jazz, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about contemporary religion and education. My guests will be John Bowker, Dean of Trinity College at Cambridge University, and Warren Nord of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Modern jazz music, its history and contemporary directions. Those are the topics this week on Soundings. Listen for the Mitchell Ruff Duo, the oldest continuous group in jazz. Joining in the conversation is nationally syndicated jazz expert Gary Shivers of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Word Jazz, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.